The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first of February 17th, What England Expects, The Importance of Rethinking Religious Education. To improve religious awareness in England, religions may have to let go of education. Not enough people want to teach the subject, and there are plenty of pupils, taxpayers, and even head teachers who are highly skeptical about its benefits. And yet there are good grounds for saying that knowledge of this sort is more vital than ever for the health and normal functioning of society. With only slight exaggeration, that odd bundle of statements describes the state of religious education in England. In recent days, several news stories have highlighted this paradox. A professional body revealed that in the current academic year, less than two-thirds of the places, 405 out of 643, in a training program for religion teachers in England have been taken up. Weak supply is meeting weak demand, it would seem. Religion came near the bottom in a survey by YouGov, an independent pollster, that asked people which subjects deserved a big role in secondary education. More than half considered religion either not very important or not at all important as an item in the curriculum, whereas only 12% deemed it very important. By comparison, some 60% of respondents regarded courses in citizenship as either very or quite important, and 85% took the same view of teaching about sex and relationships. A few months ago, it emerged that more than a quarter of England's secondary schools did not offer religion as a standalone subject, although they are legally obliged to do so. Despite all this, religious organizations play an important and in some ways increasing role in English education. The other parts of the United Kingdom have somewhat different educational and religious regimes. England is alone in having an established church. As of last year, England had nearly 7,000 state-funded schools with a religious association, of which the great majority were Christian, Anglican, or Catholic primary schools. The total included 48 Jewish, 27 Muslim, 11 Sikh, and 5 Hindu schools. The number of schools run by minority religions is rising steadily. Faith schools have been subjected to a cap which limits to 50% the number of pupils of their own religion they can take in when there is competition for places. The Catholic authorities in particular protested against this, saying that they are being forced to turn Catholic children away, and they have extracted a promise from the Conservative government to remove the quota. The National Secular Society, which campaigns against religious privilege, says this contradictory picture, lots of religious involvement in education, low public appetite for religion, underlines the need for a huge reform of the way children learn about belief systems. It wants a nationwide entitlement to instruction about different religions and philosophies, which is freed from the control of religious authorities or even local authorities. In other words, something like the state of affairs in secular France. Elsewhere in Europe, the teaching of religion is a complex patchwork, often reflecting the legal status of Christianity's locally dominant form. Each of Germany's federal states has its own system. However the subject may be taught, it is hard to deny the urgency of improving the general level of knowledge about what religions profess, what they hold sacred, and what they consider taboo. In one form or another, the challenge is facing every democratic society. For example, employment tribunals have been telling bosses that they must, within reason, respect the religious needs of their staff and respect, say, to dress, diet, and days off. The range of perceived needs is likely to get wider and wider, and not every difficult case can go to court. The limits of free speech are under perpetual debate. For good reason, democracies don't usually recognize any legal entitlement not to be offended. But in some situations, public order depends on some minimal knowledge of what words or symbols would, in practice, cause offense. Many of the hardest policy debates triggered by religion concern children. What they should be taught, what clothing and diet they should adopt, how their bodies should be treated. No level of knowledge will make these debates easy, but without a minimal understanding of where religions are coming from, such discussions cannot even begin. Lord Williams, A former head of the Church of England was asked recently how he foresaw the country's religious scene in 30 years' time. He said there was a real danger of a chaotic situation where an ever-growing number of religious subcultures coexisted deep inside their respective silos in utter ignorance of one another. That might be dismissed as special pleading by a religious leader, but it shouldn't be. The risk he describes is real. But to avert this dialogue from the profoundly deaf and to give learning about religion a better name, the champions of faith may have to dilute some of their own educational fiefdoms. By definition, they will always be more inclined to fight their own respective corners than raise the level of general knowledge. And from the Religion News Service now, of February 22nd, Ruth Graham, the silent rock behind a famous evangelist. Throughout the six decades of Billy Graham's career, his wife Ruth Bell Graham served as the only true constant in his life other than his faith. Despite long separations when Graham was on the road preaching, Ruth, who died in 2007 at age 87, remained his bedrock, often speaking up to offer advice, yet just as often staying silent so that he could focus on his mission. "There would have been no Billy Graham had it not been for Ruth," said the late T.W. Wilson, a key member of Graham's staff in A Prophet with Honor, William Martin's biography of the evangelist. Graham was the first to acknowledge his wife's importance. Quote, "Your counsel, advice, encouragement, and prayer have been my mainstay, and at times I have almost clung to you in my weakness in hours of obsession, problems, and difficulties," he wrote in a 1963 letter to Ruth from Los Angeles, according to Patricia Cornwell's biography, Ruth, A Portrait. In a statement issued at his wife's death, Graham, then age 88, praised his wife as his life partner and said, "We were called as a team. No one else could have borne the load that she carried. She was a vital and integral part of our ministry, and my work through the years would have been impossible without her encouragement and support," he said. On the surface, Ruth perhaps seemed a stereotypical preacher's wife. She stayed home in North Carolina to raise their five children and kept herself and her personal needs out of the spotlight. Her independence in the domestic arena allowed Graham a certain freedom from family responsibilities and granted him the ability to travel widely on his many crusades. The self-abnegation she learned in childhood probably prepared her for the role she played in Graham's life, said Randall Balmer, chairman of the religion department at Dartmouth College and author of a documentary on Billy Graham. She had to adjust her sense of calling and mission to fit what he had in mind. Ruth Bell was born in 1920 in China to missionary parents. By the time she met Graham at Wheaton College in Illinois and at age 20, she was used to a life of service, hardship, and separation from loved ones. Originally, she planned to follow her parents to the mission field. However, she decided instead to marry Graham in 1943 and resigned to slip into the background, as she wrote in her journal. Although she preferred to stay behind the scenes, her impact on her husband was all too evident. Early in his career, she read her King James Bible over and over and clipped newspaper and magazine articles for sermon ideas. Raised in a family that prized intellectual inquiry, she brought to the marriage a thirst for knowledge and a worldly perspective. Quote, "She proved for him a real, serious introduction to things overseas," said Mark Knoll, professor of history at the University of Notre Dame. This was important given the fact that from the early 60s through the 90s, Billy Graham was much more active in other places in the world than the United States. Her experience among missionaries, where women served in the same spiritual trenches as men, also shaped her view of gender roles. Quote, "Billy was brought up in a house where the women did not question the men, while in the Bell house, that's all we did," she said in Cornwell's biography. Ruth's steadfast adherence to the Presbyterian Church, rather than joining her husband's Southern Baptist denomination, further broadened Billy Graham's outlook. "He was more flexible than other evangelists, and his domestic influence was crucial in that regard," Knoll said. "He never got hung up on American denominational issues. That's very much a missionary characteristic, particularly in places like China, where there was a very small Christian population, and all the denominations had to learn to get along." Together with her sense of humor and love of practical jokes, Ruth's disdain for the trappings of fame and power kept Billy Graham grounded, friends said. When he got home, she put him right back on track. She didn't kowtow to him, said Cornwell, who grew up near the Grahams in Montreat, North Carolina, and first met Ruth Graham when she was 9 years old. She wasn't the typical spouse who loved being Mrs. Billy Graham in a negative sense. I hate to think what would have happened to him if she had been. Although Billy Graham acted as an informal advisor to several presidents and the Grahams considered both the Nixons and the Bushes friends, Ruth was never completely comfortable with the mix of politics and religion. When President Johnson asked Graham's opinion on potential running mates in the 1964 election, Cornwell recounted, Ruth kicked her husband under the dinner table, telling him, you're supposed to limit your advice to moral and spiritual issues and stay out of politics. She kept him humble. There were temptations to be a presidential candidate and other ambitions, said Eddie Gibbs, professor emeritus of church growth at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California, and the training director for a three-month Graham Crusade in England in 1984. But he always came back saying, my calling is as an evangelist. In my hunch, she was the steadying influence in the background. While Billy Graham ministered to millions, Ruth, in keeping with her dislike of the spotlight, tended toward a smaller scale. She befriended convicted felons, troubled teens, and drug addicts, and in 1975 persuaded Graham to help evacuate a 16-member family from Vietnam. Eventually, she slowed her ministry due to failing health. Though she rarely spoke of those she aided, her efforts could not have helped but reinforce for Graham her talents and her faith, reminding him of his belief that, quote, our marriage was planned in heaven, as he wrote to Ruth in the 1963 letter quoted in Cornwell's book. She never tried to be a theologian or lecture him. It was just a quiet influence, Cornwell said in an interview. That was not what she said, but it's what she was. And from the Southern California News Group of February 22nd, here is how Living Biblically looks at religion in today's world. J.R. Ferguson is sporting a beard, but it isn't for his new CBS multi-camera comedy, Living Biblically, which premieres Monday. It's something we were talking about in a second season, says Ferguson, who famously sported a beard during his time as art director Stan Ritzo in Mad Men. Now, his new show, he plays Chip Curry, a New York City film critic and lapsed Catholic who decides to start living in complete accordance with the Bible after a close friend dies. I was raised a Southern Baptist, very strict. That was a huge part of my life growing up, so this is not a foreign subject for me, says the 43-year-old actor. Living Biblically is based on the A.J. Jacobs best-selling 2007 nonfiction book, The Year of Living Biblically, One Man's Humble Quest to Follow the Bible as Literally as Possible. For the book, Jacobs, an at-large editor at Esquire magazine, not only followed the well-known tenets of the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule, but also lesser-known ones in Deuteronomy and Leviticus that advise against clothing that mixes fabrics together. We certainly use some stuff from the book for source material, but our stories are different, says Ferguson. I know AJ, and I've spent a lot of time with him, but it was his intention of writing a book about his experience. My character is doing it out of a desperation for some kind of guidance in his life. Dealing with religion, even as gently as Living Biblically does, is bound to draw scrutiny. I don't think there's any scenario where the show wouldn't bother someone in the world, says Patrick Walsh, the showrunner for the comedy, which is from Big Bang Theory star Johnny Galecki's production company. Ferguson, who grew up in Texas until being cast in a TV series at 14, says he's excited about Living Biblically because of the divisions he sees in the country. We've gotten away from the notion that we have far more in common than what separates us, no matter what we believe, says the actor. I saw this as a wonderful opportunity to possibly cut through the hypocrisy that seems to have taken over as of late. One of the biggest hurdles is the fear to have the conversation about religion, says Galecki, who doesn't appear in the 13 episodes already shot for the first season. Of course, anyone who has read the Bible knows that there are numerous passages, like putting adulterers to death, that run smack up against modern social mores. Chip, thankfully, is faithful to his pregnant wife, Leslie, played by Lindsay Kraft, Though not really a believer, she supports his sometimes impractical quest. His tough-minded editor at the newspaper, Ms. Meadows, played by The Practice's Cameron Manheim, does too, knowing his articles about it will generate readers. Being a film critic living in Manhattan is a challenge for Chip on a daily basis, notes Ferguson. He has to deal with all sorts of characters in the newspaper offices from all walks of life and different beliefs. To stay on the righteous path, Chip enlists his own God Squad, a Catholic priest, played by Ian Gomez, and a rabbi, played by David Krumholtz, to offer him practical advice. Coincidentally, the show itself has both a priest and a rabbi serving as consultants. They'll chime in and give us notes and let us know if we're too far off base, says Ferguson. They also offer different suggestions of Bible verses that might be better suited for whatever it is we're talking about. He adds, it's great to know that we've got them to fall back on, so people know that it's not just a bunch of Hollywood weirdos sitting in a room riffing on religion. They make sure that what we're doing is respectful, and hopefully won't be misconstrued and offensive. While Living Biblically is a comedy, the showrunners know that it will have to deal with some of the more controversial aspects of the Good Book. As far as homosexuality, that is ideally a season two episode, says Walsh. It was discussed and discussed, and we couldn't break it. As far as the misogyny in the Bible, that is episode 8. We do tackle these issues head-on. We're not pretending they don't exist. There are certain things that Chip, as a modern man living by the Bible, won't do, adds Walsh. He will not be hateful. I don't think those things are biblical attitudes, and the show won't reflect that. Living Biblically is filmed in front of a live studio audience, which Ferguson, whose long career got a boost for his time on Mad Men, hasn't done since he was on the Burt Reynolds sitcom Evening Shade in the early 90s. The actor says he was a bit nervous about it, but is really enjoying it and is looking forward to more. Plus, the experience allows him to, and others, to get immediate feedback from the crowd. It's a collaborative environment, says Ferguson, though he's not sure if the religious experts have chimed in with any jokes yet. Like Walsh, Ferguson knows the show isn't going to please everybody. There's always going to be somebody who is rubbed the wrong way, he says. But he hopes that Living Biblically is an opportunity to stress shared values, like that it's better to give than receive, and that one should not covet another's partner or stuff, that people can get behind no matter if you're Christian, Muslim, Jewish, or atheist. We all have in common more than we are led to believe by some elected officials and people with loud voices, says Ferguson. But don't get me started. I can go all day about this. It's all about unification and less about the division. And that's Living Biblically, a new comedy about a modern New York City man literally trying to live by the tenets of the Bible. Premieres 9:30 on Monday, February 26th on CBS. And back to The Economist of February 23rd. America, Russia, and Christianity. Why Billy Graham went to Russia. The sneaking sympathy felt by American evangelicals towards Russia goes back to their most famous representative. Religious Americans often have mixed feelings about Russia. In recent times, many have waxed indignant at the way Russia curbs most forms of religious practice and preaching, apart from the ones that enjoy an official stamp of approval, which is to say, Russian Orthodoxy and established forms of Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism. In its most recent annual report, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, a bipartisan agency, placed Russia on the list of egregious violators of religious freedom, arguing that its record had worsened in every recent year, not only within its own territory, but also in Russian-dominated parts of Ukraine. But that isn't the whole story. On America's religious right, and in particular on the isolationist right, a powerful groundswell of opinion applauds Vladimir Putin on at least two grounds. The Russian president's self-appointment as an international guardian of traditional values with respect to marriage, sexuality, and reproduction, and his advocacy of the rights of persecuted Christians in the Middle East, which has been a Russian concern that goes back to Tsarist times. Consider this extraordinary reversal. It was at a gathering of America's National Association of Evangelicals in 1983 that, with his famous denunciation of the Soviet Union as, quote, an evil empire, President Ronald Reagan implied that the Cold War was a moral contest rather than a misunderstanding over in which both sides bore blame. Some 30 years later, Pat Buchanan, a conservative pundit, noted with some approval that Mr. Putin was turning that accusation on its head by denouncing Barack Obama's America as a realm of sinfulness, where decadent ideas like same-sex marriage were on the march. At a minimum, the Russian president had a point, said Mr. Buchanan, who likewise shared Mr. Putin's disapproval of the barbarity and blood caused by ill-advised American military actions around the world. No evangelical has been as defensive of Russia and of American relations with Russia as Franklin Graham, a preacher and White House confidant. As a previous Erasmus post has noted, last year he urged Americans to pray for the success of a meeting between Mr. Putin and President Donald Trump. Mr. Graham also gave a warm welcome to a Russian Orthodox grandees at a conference in Washington on religious freedom in the Middle East. The conference was originally due to happen in Moscow, but the venue was switched after some American evangelicals protested over the persecution of their co-religionists in Russia. A determination to keep channels of communication to Moscow open, even when political and religious friends urge otherwise, is a trait Mr. Graham shared with his father, the great preacher Billy Graham, who died this week. In a rare act of defiance of the Republican establishment, Billy Graham accepted an invitation to a peace conference in Moscow in 1982, at a time when the Cold War was entering its final bitter phase. Critical friends, including the then Vice President George H.W. Bush, said his visit could be a propaganda gift to the Soviet authorities. It would mean colluding with the Soviet regime's claim to respect religious freedom and with the politically subservient Russian Orthodox Church's insistence that there was no real persecution. This week after Graham's death, an American writer on religion and pacifism, Jim Forrest, recalled a conversation he had with the famous preacher in which Graham stoutly defended that journey. The conversation took place in Kiev in 1988, when Graham was making yet another Soviet visit, this time to attend ceremonies marking the millennium of the Slavs' Christian conversion. Graham said that in 1982, quote, "I had been briefed at the Pentagon about what would happen if there were a nuclear war. I had been to Auschwitz and seen how limitless is our capacity for evil. And I was thinking about the Christian Apostle Paul saying in his first letter to the Corinthians that he was called to be all things to all people. And I realized I had closed myself to the people of the Soviet Union." Perhaps one conclusion from that arresting statement is that however close religious leaders get to political ones, the moral calculus made by the former is never exactly the same as that of their more earthly-minded friends. To be worth the name, spiritual leaders will sometimes follow a different imperative. And back to the Religion News Service now, from February 22nd. At the Olympics, thousands of missionaries compete for souls. From Pyeongchang, to those watching on TV, religion may seem absent from the Winter Olympic Games. Away from the spotlight, though, an estimated 3,000 missionaries are on hand. About 2,000 missionaries, South Korean and international, are working in the city of Gangneung, where the indoor Olympic events are being held. The remaining 1,000 are working in Pyeongchang, site of ski, snowboard, and other events. There is no reliable count of missionaries at Olympics past, but the number of local missionaries here far exceeds previous games, said Marty Youngblood, leader of the Georgia Baptist Convention mission team, who is at his fifth Olympics this year. South Korea, which is 29% Christian, and among whom Protestants predominate, enjoys high levels of religious tolerance. The Buddha's birthday and Christmas are both national holidays. The Winter Games have attracted teams of Baptists, Presbyterians, and Methodists. Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons also abound, each group sharing the gospel in its own way. The United Christian Churches of Korea, a coalition of 144 local congregations, is helping foreign mission groups to arrange housing and ministry sites and learn about Korean culture. Local churches are taking advantage of an Olympics at their doorstep. Many have set up welcome stations and parking lots where they give away snacks, coffee, and Christian literature. In addition to its coffee and snack giveaway, Somang Presbyterian Church, located in the shadow of the Olympic venues, is showcasing a live orchestra and church members dressed in traditional costume. It's just one of these 26 local churches there with Olympic outreach ministries. Then there is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Helping Hands Center, a two-story building on prime real estate across the street from the train station in Gwangyang. Working there is a Coloradan, Chandler Petrie, chosen by her church with a small group of other Mormon missionaries already in Korea to serve at the Olympics. The center's multilingual staff will give athletes, members of the media, and any Olympic spectator a warm drink and a place to recharge their phones. But its main goal, according to the church's website, quote, is for as many as possible to see the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ in the eyes of the members and missionaries. The Jehovah's Witnesses have sent about 1,000 missionaries to the Winter Games, far more than to previous Olympics, said Stephen Park, public information officer for the Jehovah's Witness Korea branch. He says that the work they do there is no different from the ministry they do elsewhere, and that some missionaries will remain in the area after the Olympics. One of the most popular tools of ministry for these Olympic missionaries has been lapel pin trading. Moon Sung No, a campus minister in Seoul, says his students from the Baptist Student Union use pin trading, a pastime at this and previous Olympics, to spread the gospel. While athletes and spectators trade pins that typically depict a certain country, sport, or team, mission groups give away a more-than-gold lapel pin, borrowing the slogan a consortium of missionary groups adopted in the 1990s to brand their Olympic outreach. Psalm 119 declares that the commands of God are loved more than gold. The reference to gold at the Olympics, where athletes' highest reward for their performance is a gold medal, is borrowed from by the missionaries to suggest that there is a higher reward to be sought through faith. Veteran missionaries trained in the art of Olympic pin trading are passing down the skill to new generations. The missionaries make an initial pin trade using a non-religious pin they've collected, say, that of the USA ski jump team. This often prompts a conversation and a chance for the missionary to offer the trader the more-than-gold pin as a gift. Some missionaries who work elsewhere in Asia have decided to take a break to focus on the Olympics. American Catherine Daniel, based in China, says she felt called to evangelize at the Winter Games because of her personal connection with Korea. She spent 12 years of her life in the country with her missionary parents. 9 months ago, she heard her father was getting a group of other retired missionaries to go to the Olympics, and she thought, I think this is God telling me to go. Kathy, just go. Daniel is staying in Korea for a week, working with the group from the Georgia Baptist Convention. The first weekend of the Olympics, mission groups passed out Christian literature in the Olympic Park unimpeded. Then Olympic Park officials posted signs informing visitors that passing out religious material in the park was banned and any materials found would be confiscated. Youngblood of the Georgia Baptist Convention says he's not concerned. His missionaries are also using the pin trading and only give pamphlets to those who want to learn more. And Ah Lim Chang, a recent university graduate and student leader with the Baptist Student Union missionaries, said the pin trading had allowed her and her colleagues to share the gospel, quote, with many people that God's put in our path. That's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.